There we go.
Okay, we are on the air. Welcome to On .NET, a weekly discussion with the .NET team and guests. I'm Bertrand Leroy, and our guest this week is Rachel Rees from Jet.com. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Rachel Rees. I'm actually sitting here at the Jet hangar, we like to call it, our headquarters, at lunch while, it's actually completely silent finally, and everyone is off, at lunch. So I grabbed a conference room, and we actually have these really cool conference rooms. All of the walls have been set up to be whiteboards, so you can just grab a marker and write on any wall. Yeah, so that's the reflective spot.
So the reason why we have you on the show today, we like you obviously, but that's not the only reason, is that so you're working at Jet.com, which is a very interesting startup with an interesting model, and all of your stuff is F# microservices, right?
Yes. So we are a very interesting startup. We are taking on Amazon, where e-commerce, you can buy, basically anything that you can get on Amazon, you can also get on Jet. And we have doubled down on .NET and F#, microservices, event-driven microservices even. And it's been a fascinating run. So actually one of the questions I got a lot when I first started speaking was a lot of people asking me, how we're using F# with AWS. I was like, well, we're competing with Amazon, so we're using Azure.
Okay.
And it actually has been working out quite well.
So I guess one of the first questions you get about what you guys are doing is why F# and what does it change for you?
A couple different reasons. So I know our CTO, Mike, attended a conference ages ago, 2012. There's a Skills Matter generally holds a what's called the Progressive .NET Progressive F# tutorials in New York City every year-ish. And they held the first one about then. Mike attended and learned about F#, and it was still in that phase where a lot of people thought that F# was good for math and finance sort of only. And Mike had been thinking about this site and sort of preparing to start working on it, and thought, well, it's going to need a pricing engine, so this seems like a perfect fit for F#, and we'll run this pricing engine in F#. And so a few years later, when he started to hire the engineers, he hired a couple specifically to work on the pricing engine in F#. And as that sort of developed, there were a few C# engineers and a few F# engineers.
So at that time, your code base was mixed F# and C#.
Yes. And there started to be more and more discussions about how to move forward and which pieces to build in F# and which pieces to build in C#. And they decided to basically move forward with two completely separate solutions, one entirely in C# and one entirely in F#. And see what happened. It was the very, very early days of a startup. There were like 10 employees. I'm like, sure, we'll see where this goes. And obviously F# won for two reasons. From the code point of view, the main was all the overarching concerns, logging and things like that, being able to use a composition with F#. And being able to handle things like that using composition and using F# basically just made it so much cleaner and easier to work with. And they kept trying to make C# to fit this model that just wasn't working for our code base. And when you can do something in what looks like three or four lines rather than including an entire library that doesn't quite fit, it just ended up being a lot better. But from a non-code point of view, one of the other things that the team had noticed was that a lot of the folks who are attending the F-Sharp user group basically were in F-Sharp enthusiasts who didn't have day jobs in F-Sharp. And they started to think, you know, especially from a management perspective, we can really clean up here and take a lot of this talent early on. And, you know, it's, we have actually been able to. I mean, we've had
so you've hired folks. You've hired all of the F-Sharp developers, all of them?
Almost anyone who will move to New York City, yes. But it's, I mean, even as compared to the other functional languages, I mean, they could have switched stacks entirely and like, well, there's going to be a lot of competition in the Clojure world and in the Scala world. And that's just, you know, in F-Sharp, we're not going to have that. Plus we have, you know, Microsoft tooling and other awesome .NET things.
So was it a consensus thing where pretty much everybody in the company agreed that F-Sharp was the way to go?
The... From my understanding, yes, I wasn't there at that point, but even the C-sharp devs at that point were writing very functional C-sharp using tons and tons of link, and they just thought, yeah, this is basically the direction that we're moving in our C-sharp code anyway, so we might as well just take the jump.
Interesting. What about your personal journey with F-sharp? How did you personally start using F-sharp? And
sure. I started in sort of in 2010. I believe it was a tech ed where I don't know if it was released, but there was lots of talk around F-Sharp. And I had attended that year, and people kept saying, you should check out F-Sharp. It's really cool. It's the new hotness on .NET, and you'll love it. It's amazing. And I thought, yeah, okay, I suppose I should look at this. This is a new thing. I'll get to it at some point. And I slowly tried. I started looking at the Project Euler problems a little bit. I sort of toyed with it off and on for about 2 years. And that same Skills Matter conference that the CTO attended, I was actually there as well. And the two tutorials that they had split into two tracks, a beginner track and an advanced track for the whole conference. But for the first day, the first one was working through, I think, the F-sharp Cohen's, which are just a whole bunch of failing tests that you end up fixing to just become more familiar with the language and how the syntax works and some of the features. And those, I had done those. And I'm certain that I would have gotten something more out of it. I probably would have been able to go further. I would have been able to ask questions and such. But I thought, I'll jump into the advanced track and probably not understand a thing and see what happens. And it was Don Syme and Keith Bitacci talking about type providers. And I just sat there wide-eyed thinking, this is the most incredible thing I have ever heard of. And this first of all, could have completely transformed everything that I had been doing at my current job and would have made the like 3 month long disaster project turn into 8 lines of code. But it, not exactly that much, but I just, that was sort of my turning point. Like, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard of. And from there, I was living in Vermont at the time. So I went, you know, back to Vermont from New York City and started up a functional user group, which again was mind blowing. You know, I had had very little time outside the .NET world. And suddenly I was, you know, there were maybe 10 or 15 folks that had joined the functional group. And there were Clojure folks, Scala folks, Racket people, you know, just sort of all of these. I had no idea Racket was a language. And now 2 months later, I'm seeing talks on it. And that, yeah.
So it seems like everybody I speak with who is doing F-Sharp is a huge fan. would prefer to not do anything but F-Sharp. So why hasn't it taken over the world? I mean, not just F-Sharp, but functional languages in general.
In general? I don't know. There baffles the mind. There's definitely a bit of a learning curve. it is, I suppose, a few things. It is very difficult to get out of, you know, that space where you're very comfortable. Sort of.
So do you mean all the old people have to die?
No, I realized that I was sort of starting to say that, and that's actually not what I mean, because there are plenty of new things that people do embrace every year. And, you know, it isn't that difficult, but it is a completely different way of thinking, and it's hard to sort of play around with it without, it's hard to really start working with F sharp and not completely transform your thinking. So it's, there is some time there, but in one sense, totally worth it, of course. But it's also, I've worked in a lot of companies who don't like to stray off the common path. And I think that's where F sharp is being heard a lot. That,
do you think functional languages suffer from maybe a part of the community pushing the mathematical aspect of it, which can be daunting, right?
Yes.
And it's definitely very interesting if you're into that sort of thing, and there's a lot to be said about it, but is it something that is scaring people away from it?
I think very much. I think it's difficult to, I think a lot of people don't realize that just because there are these really amazing, very fascinating mathematical aspects doesn't mean you need to actually know them to program in F sharp. One of the examples that I will use often is, you know, you don't have to understand the mechanics and the electronics behind your phone to be able to use it. Like it's sort of the same thing. Like it's
okay. So you don't even have to understand monads to
do functional programming. I only very recently have started to grasp monads a little.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a feature. Like you don't need to understand properly what, you know, a lot of programming constructs do in general.
Okay, so object-oriented programming is fairly easy to explain, right? So you have those data structures that also have behavior all packed into one single thing, and you can dot and see properties, and I mean you can go farther, I'll talk about encapsulation and, you know, all the principles.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's where I was going. I was like,
what is the equivalent description for functional languages?
It's about doing things. I suppose it's a more active, you're not just looking at an object, you're looking at how something can be transformed or how information can change or flow, perhaps.
Yeah, it's more about flow than behavior, maybe.
Yeah. And I suppose
And transformations,
yeah. One of the starting places I will usually go with in like my very introductory talks is just, you know, how mapping works and how, you know, a piping works, and taking something from through just a series of transformations and, you know, a data in, data out sort of.
Yeah, so on a website, for example, you get the request in. What happens to all that to obtain the response?
And yeah.
All the steps in the way, how you get data from the database, services, and so on. Okay. What about the microservice aspect of what you're doing at
That's been really fascinating. It's not an architecture I had any experience with before, but it's, so we have a few sort of rules. Microservices mean a lot of things to a lot of different people, is what I have come to realize once I started, you know, trying to understand what we were doing. And for us, it just means a, an implementation of, making something as small as possible. Not going to any great lengths. Some people will say it has to be exactly one function, and for us, it's more about one implementation of something. Not necessarily so a one functional aspect. The code should perform just one thing.
So it's more about doing one thing and doing it well. It's not really about distributing the load or
exactly.
But it is that as well, right?
Yes, there is that benefit. Once you have that one small piece, it is very easy to distribute, and especially functional, because we're not handling any states. It is more about that transformation. There's data in here, data out. There's no state maintained. You can, scale it up and out very, very easily.
So does it mean that there is a particular synergy between what F# is as a language and HTTP as a stateless protocol?
I would say yes. I would say even functional in general.
Yeah.
So
everybody should do functional languages.
Obviously.
How is it taught in universities and engineering schools?
F# specifically, I don't know. I wasn't even a
computer science major. Functional in general.
I know that I believe it's even ML is generally used for the compilers class. And so everybody learns it and hates it because nobody wants to build a compiler, and this is hard and complicated. I've heard a fair amount of complaints. Like, it's like, oh yeah, sure, I learned a bit of that, and it was awful.
So maybe something like F#, which is actually quite fun to learn, would be a good way to introduce young engineers to functional programming without the pain.
I would definitely say that. I know that Phil Trelford, you've probably heard of, his son Sean has been speaking on F# now, and I think he's 8 or 9.
What?
Right?
Okay, so now I'm panicking because my 8-year-old and my 12-year-old know nothing about that.
Yeah, he's actually, so tomorrow is F# Conf, and Sean has a demo as part of that.
We announced that on the weekend.net blog, so people can check that out. And so where is it?
It's online. It's on Channel 9. Is
excellent. So anybody can attend.
Yeah.
All through the world. Cool. Very cool. So how does jet.com work exactly? You said that you guys are selling pretty much anything that Amazon is selling, which means that you're selling pretty much anything. I can probably buy some uranium.
Well, totally,
yeah. But
easy to find.
Because you have an interesting way of calculating prices, right? That's kind of your edge.
Pricing,
like Amazon.
The pricing is really, really cool. We have the concept of a smart cart, and basically the merchants on the back end are allowed to set huge numbers of rules. I don't know what exactly, but they can say that they will ship to some place, but only if, the prices in this area or for these certain items, or only if they're the only supplier. If they're going to end up losing more money, then they'll be able to choose exactly how and where they'll ship. So we can combine all of that and know if you're combining merchants either who are one merchant who's selling several similar things, or from our warehouses. and say, you know, that's going to be cheaper for us to ship, and so we'll give you a discount on that. So as you add more things, like I was buying diapers and formula the other day, and I decided to buy a couple extras because, especially with the same item, you know it's coming from exactly the same place. And I was getting like 50 cents off if I bought one of them, plus like 75 cents off each item if I bought two, and it would just go up from there. And so gathering items that all come from the same place gives you extra discounts over the original price.
Yeah, so you have all those rules that enable you to lower the prices depending on a multitude of factors. So I imagine that that must be really fun to model.
That's one of the pieces of the code that I haven't looked at that I would really like to get into, that really does just fascinate me. There's some very interesting things going on there. One of the teams I worked on when I first started was actually the warehouse team. And so they were handling all of the, you know, the stocking of the warehouse, the shipping from the warehouse, all of the technology that needed to go into maintaining what was actually there and how that all worked. And that was interesting as well. It never occurred to me that there would be so much work and so much technology behind a warehouse, which makes sense now, but
because you're also stocking the products and shipping them.
Yeah, some of them. A lot of the sort of basic supply, you know, laundry detergent, dishwashing detergent, formula, stuff like that, your base pantry
so
supplies.
It is really like Amazon. The people who sell stuff on Jet.com have the same options to sell directly and ship directly if they want to, or to give you some of their stock and then you do all that for them.
I'm not 100% sure if we do the sold by somebody else but fulfilled by us. I think we don't do that yet. I'm not 100% sure on that. But yes, we have like sold by us in our warehouses and sold by somebody else and shipped by someone else.
So if I want to sell something on Jet.com, what does the UI look like? Because specifying all those rules must be kind of complex, and it sounds like a programming task. So how do you present that to your customers who are selling?
Very carefully, and again, that's not something I have looked at in quite a while. but there are just zillions of options and ways to be able to configure all of these things. So I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. Well, I'm interested because I've been in that sort of business of selling stuff online, and the places where you can, all the websites where you can sell stuff, be it Amazon or Newegg, etc. Their UI is not always that great. So
I know we very much pride ourselves on being one of the most merchant-friendly spots.
Yeah. And I imagine you have lots of people who are supporting the interaction with merchants.
Very much, yeah.
So how many people are working at Jet?
Oof. Including the warehouses and the call centers and everything, we went over 1,000 maybe a month ago. We might be at 11 or 1200 now.
How many developers?
80-ish. Probably still less than 100, but maybe 80 to 90.
Are you hiring?
Oh, yes.
Go ahead.
Please. If you're interested in working with us, we do, I mean, obviously we have the F#, we have the microservices, we have Azure. We are not exclusively a .NET shop, though. We do, you know, we have a fair amount of Linux boxes. We, you know, work with Kafka and Docker, and we are interested in anyone who has either heavy .NET experience or heavy functional experience. We will train you either way. That's actually one of my jobs. We provide relocation. So we don't offer remote yet, but we do offer relocation to the New York City area. And if you're interested, contact either me, Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L, at jet.com, or Amy, our best recruiter, A-I-M-E-E, at jet.com.
So let's talk about training new hires. I would imagine that most of your hires are actually C-sharp developers.
A lot of them. It's, yes, the vast majority, although a lot of my training materials speak to that. And every now and again, I'll get somebody who knows, you know, Python and Haskell. I'm like, well, these comparison code examples might not mean anything to you, but I promise it's useful. So I do need to expand those out a little bit. But yeah, so as part of orientation, we have one afternoon workshop that goes through, you know, introductory functional concepts, really, but with F#. And then from there, we have a couple ongoing programs. We have one thing where we'll, you know, every Tuesday we'll either have somebody internal or external come and speak to us, just, you know, give a conference talk. If we don't have either of those, we'll just watch a conference video. So we all gather in one of the big rooms and, you know, eat lunch together and watch something. We also have a couple hours each week of sort of proper hands-on training. And it varies all over the place. It's, you know, we've had trainings on Docker and Splunk, some of the F# libraries, Fake and Packet, we've gone into. We've also done really introductory program, intro to programming, how to set up your environment if this is something you're interested in. And one of my goals eventually is to be able to have a process for folks who are interested in tech, but, you know, maybe are somewhere else in the company, can transition in and start like at a very junior level and work their way up.
Are you using a lot of external material, or
if there's,
or are you creating your own?
It's a bit of a mix. Like I know one of our developers right now is working on an F# Kafka library, which we are eventually going to open source. But there is so much open source material in the F# community that we have been taking advantage of a lot of it.
are you open sourcing a lot of your code?
In my mind, not enough yet. but it is definitely a goal. I know that last year's goal was to just launch. And so now that we're there, you know, goal number one is maintain the site and, you know, improve and everything. But past that, start really giving back to the community and make sure that we're interacting and doing a lot more and sharing what we have been doing.
So why is it important to you to give back to the community beyond the moral aspect of it, which is important? But how do you convince your board, for example, that, yeah, we need to do as much open source as possible?
My boss is at the CTO is actually fully behind it.
That helps.
It really does help. So my view, and I suppose his view, is that by sharing what we're doing, we attract better talent because then folks know what it is that we're working on and that it is actually as cool as we claimed that it is. So, you know, making sure that things are open sourced, making sure that I and the other developers are out in the community giving talks and sharing and talking about this.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, there's no better or really other way, and, you know, making sure there's constant flow on the blog, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and making sure people are aware of the things we're doing.
Are you getting contributions on the stuff you already have open source?
A little bit. Ages ago, I forked FS Blog to start our blog, and I've gotten a few contributions back from that.
Yeah, but you're not yet at the point where you have regular contributors that you might actually want to hire?
Not yet, no.
That's the idea.
Yeah, that is the ideal, of course, yeah.
Oh, we're getting some spam on the chat. Interesting. That's the first time it happens. Can I block someone? I probably can. Person with zero subscribers, of course. Okay. Well, anyway. I'm sorry, that was completely...
No, that's fine. I just realized I didn't have the chat up.
You don't have to.
Okay, good.
I'm just, you know, keeping an eye on it. I just noticed some activity there. As usual, I encourage anyone to ask questions
that
are not spammy like these.
Real questions.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about is, seeing that you do a lot of microservices, do you also use an actor model kind of architecture?
Yes and no. So in my view, microservices are very much an actor model naturally.
Yeah.
We don't specifically use the F# mailbox processor, though. We do in a few places, but not necessarily for every microservice. I do see a lot of very natural, I feel like microservices in and of themselves are sort of an actor. There's, you know, a message coming in, it gets processes, and message going out at the end, there's that sort of very natural.
So how do you distribute the messages across the system?
By using, in some cases, Event Store, in some cases, Kafka, but in most
What's
cases,
Kafka?
It's something I really need to look up and like make sure I know offhand, because this is like the eighth time I've gotten this question. That's okay.
I put you on the spot here. Okay, so you have a message bus. Is this something that is specific to Jet.com or
Kafka? No.
I mean, Kafka is the message bus that you're using. I'm sorry,
yes?
I don't know what it is. I know the author, but
yeah, I know that we have one. We have some, and it is not something that is specific to Jet. It is a very general product.
So what about your hardware architecture? How do you scale that thing?
We tend to have, so we'll group the microservices by function, sort of a bounded context, and have three or four of them together on a VM and scale that VM. Because if they're related, we might as well keep them together rather than having, one service per VM. And my understanding is most of that is just scaled automatically with Azure.
Okay. Do you have any specific performance problems that are related to communicating between those guys?
I know that we have had some, and that the vast majority of the issues that we had, and I know there were a few really major issues right around launch, and those have all been handled. We work really, really closely with a few folks on the Azure team, so any issues that we do see get handled very quickly. Whether it's our fault or theirs.
How do you deal with deployment? Do you have the ability to deploy service by service, or do you actually deploy a completely new platform?
We can deploy service by service. In general, we will group the services into a few projects within a solution. And for the most part, we'll deploy either a project or the full solution at a time, just for ease. But if we needed to, we could deploy a single one.
How often do you deploy?
As needed. I know. Around November and December, we slowed down quite a bit because Christmas and shopping season, and we wanted to, be very clear that anything going up onto the site was perfect. Mm-hmm. So for a while, we did slow down, but I know when we first started, it was, you know, 0 to 15 times a day, depending on what, how things were progressing.
Do you have a release engineer who takes care of just that, or is it, or do you have a more flexible kind of process to deploy?
We don't have a specific release engineer. It's up to each individual engineer who is releasing their own service. And then we have DevOps to facilitate anything.
Right.
Else. Yeah.
That makes sense.
We also, somewhat recently in the last 4 or 5 months, we have spun up a chaos testing program. So much like Netflix Chaos Monkey, we have a team, and we had to start it in QA, but we still, you know, we have automatic services that will go through and, you know, take down an instance of a service and log it and just be like, it's down now. Hope it restarted.
Nice.
Yeah, that's been really interesting. We found a couple of really good bugs. And yeah. I am blanking on all of them offhand, so don't ask me, but some actually really fascinating ones.
Carlos is asking if you can talk about those issues that you had early on, if that's okay. And even if those issues have been solved, you said that you had some really tricky performance issues at launch.
There was one. I don't recall the exact details because it's been a while. Launch was last July. But there was one specifically with Node. We use a lot of Node on our front end. And there was something weird where we weren't able to get any sort of throughput on the front end with something. And it came down to something really tricky. I don't remember the details, but I remember it ended up being solved in the 11th hour, and that everyone, I remember everyone really panicking about it for a while.
Carlos is also asking how you manage your versioning.
Ah, yes. It's a good question. I know that we have, and I've known this, I've been concentrating so much on the training and the evangelism lately that I've been a little further from the code than I would like. I know we have a solution for it, and I don't remember what it is. I am so sorry.
It's okay. Yeah, we can probably focus on what you're currently doing. I think that's actually very interesting, how we get people to try F# and not be intimidated by it. And so are there any resources that you would recommend for people who know C# and want to try F#?
A couple things. Tryfsharp.org is an online F# site where you can just go in and play around with it. I know they're reworking it a little bit, and that it had some issues recently, I believe, with IE, or not IE, whatever the new IE is called. Edge, thank you. I use it on all my VMs. The other really, really, really excellent place is F# for Fun and Profit. Scott Vlashin has a really wonderful blog that goes tremendously in depth. He's actually writing a book on, you know, an intro to F# book that will also be really wonderful when that is actually out. That's my favorite place. There's also an F# Slack channel. There's even, I found out recently, a beginner F# Slack channel on, I think it's functionalprogramming.slack.com.
Okay, we'll put all the links in the description.
Perfect.
For the show. So tryfsharp.org is one of those sites where you can type code and have it execute in the browser, right?
Yes, yeah.
Well, or probably on a server somewhere, but it looks like you're running code directly. And you can you can load some tutorials and try the code directly. So that's a very interesting site. Probably the best way to start, because you don't have to install anything, right?
Yeah,
you don't need to have Visual Studio.
And there is Visual Studio Code and Visual Studio Community. I think it handles F# a lot better.
How is the support for F# in VS Code nowadays?
It might be improved. I think when it came out, though, it was awful. I forget which one's which. I confuse Visual Studio Code and Visual Studio Community. But one of them works perfectly fine, and one of them, at least when it came out, was just nearly unusable for F#.
So David Stevens could probably confirm that, but I think things have become a lot better.
Okay.
You should try it again then.
I suppose you
spend all your life in Visual Studio, so
yeah.
You probably don't
actually
feel
this week it has been all Xamarin Studio. I'm writing demo apps for the Evolve conference.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's talk about Mono.
So Mono is part of, and Xamarin are part of Microsoft now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge for them.
And for us. It seems like there is a good synergy between Xamarin and F#. Why is that?
It's, well, one, I think, because Miguel loves F#. I think there's... that has very much filtered down through the rest of Xamarin, and it's always been not top priority, because C# obviously is still where the money is going to be, but it has been definitively a priority, and that comes through. That's has honestly been my only concern. F# has not necessarily always appeared to be a priority from Microsoft's point of view, and that's definitely changing, and that may or may not be valid. But that has worried me a little bit with the acquisition. And I trust Xamarin to...
Sorry.
I very much trust Xamarin to keep the F# love going. Maybe because of the open source world that, you know, F# was one of the very early adopters of, you know, went open source. I think it was 2010 when F#, the language, was open sourced. And because, you know, Mono obviously has always been open source, maybe that was also an early affinity.
But. Yeah, it's always had a very strong community, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Okay. So you're talking at the Xamarin conference.
Yes.
When is that?
The end of April. I think it's the 24th to the 28th. My conference schedule this year has gotten just completely wild.
It's in 52 days. The conference's name is Evolve. So you can go to evolve.xamarin.com, and it's in Orlando from April 24th to April 28th.
Yes. Okay, good.
And you're talking about?
I'm going to have a talk on Xamarin Forms with F# generally.
Okay.
We finally are starting to build an app internally at Jet using Xamarin. And so I don't know how much of that I will be able to show off, because it's internal and it's also very new, so I don't know how much we'll be, you know, ready to show off, but hopefully show off some pieces of that as well.
So you're going to meet with Steve Wozniak and Granty Mahara. Did you know that we are going to be at the conference? You didn't know? Oh, Charles Spitzold. The cast of the conference is amazing.
Charles, I got to meet last year, and is absolutely wonderful. Charles is one of the nicest people I've ever met.
You're not on the list of speakers.
I don't believe you.
Are you sure you're talking?
I only confirmed. I was a late addition. I only confirmed a couple weeks ago.
Oh, so
that could be why. But I promise they told me I'm speaking.
You need to nag them so that you're on the side. Yeah, it's a very nice website, by the way.
Yeah, last year it was a really excellent conference. It was definitely one of the top conferences I went to last year.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah, we put the link in the description as well.
Perfect.
Our spammer is still there and complaining that this is boring and I can't English.
That's awesome.
Oh, well. okay, so I know you have a hard stop today. We can't go over the hour. Anything else you wanna talk about?
I mentioned it before, but I would definitely recommend folks check out F-Sharp Conference tomorrow on Channel 9. Yep. That'll have a lot of really excellent content. If anyone in London is listening, I will be there next week speaking at the user group and at QCon. Definitely, you know, apply to JED if you can, if you're interested. And come meet me if I'm at a conference. That would be awesome, I suppose.
Cool. And if people want to know more about all this, you also did Hansel Minutes a couple of months ago.
I did a Hansel Minutes. I've done No Dogma podcast this week also, which is not out yet, but should be like early next week.
Okay.
Check out the JET blog, tech.jet.com.
We're going to have a lot of links.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Oh, and as part of F-Sharp Conf tomorrow, I will be, you know, talking more on JET and microservices and such.
The topic tomorrow is JET?
The topic for my talk tomorrow is JET, yes.
Okay, very cool. So I'll get the link for that as well. Great. Well, thanks for speaking with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. And we'll talk again next week. And again, once more, I don't know who my guest is next week. So we'll see. Excellent. Well, thanks again, Rachel. And thanks to everyone who watched the show. And we'll see you again next week. Bye.
See everyone.